This episode of The Blotter Presents is brought to you, in part, by Best Fiends. Sponsors like Best Fiends keep the lights on here at Blotter HQ, so keep an ear out for that ad later in the episode. And said episode starts right now.
You could tell it was a guy who was intellectually enjoying this and is not stupid, because a lot of criminals are stupid, or at least ignorant, and they don't do things like the Unabomber did. They don't conduct their campaign of terror the way the Unabomber is conducting his campaign of terror.
I'm not sure what to make of the fact that Netflix borrowed its latest true crime limited series, Unabomber in his own words, from Reels with a Z, a channel only I even admit to watching. My guest and I aren't sure what to make of the series itself, and whether it's trying to humanize Ted Kaczynski while also letting the FBI explain why it took nearly two decades to catch the dude. Later, we're discussing recent podcast Strictly Stalking and the gap between cultural values and production values. What's the sentencing guideline for felony tryhard? Let's find out. It's The Blotter Presents, episode 133. Welcome back to The Blotter Presents, a podcast that tries to find the true crime with value to you. I'm your host, Sarah D. Bunting, and I am joined by first-time guest, Jessica Lease. Hello, Jess.
Hi, Sarah. Thanks for having me on.
Thank you so much for coming on. We've got a bunch of most wanted stuff to get into, literally and figuratively, so let's get to it. We are starting with Unabomber in his own words. I'm not exactly sure how accurate that title really is in terms of the dominance of these tapes to the narrative, and I think it was called something else when it was on the Reels channel, which mostly is garbage like the autopsy of ... Not that I would know, because I certainly never watched that channel.
Was Reels the one that did the JFK miniseries like
maybe
a few years ago?
Or maybe they were the only ones who like consented to air it because it was so terrible.
That could be. Like, maybe that's just their motto. We air the stuff that nobody else wants.
Yeah. Or that's just like too tacky to contemplate. Like, someone made that. Reels is like, and that's where we're a Viking. I don't know. I will issue a content warning if you are planning to watch the series, for there is some gore that I was a little surprised that they lingered on these close-ups of post-shrapnel injuries. So if you're not keen on that, why would you be? And, you'll know when it's coming, but content warning for that. Here's the case file on Unabomber in his own words. Per Wikipedia, quote, between 1978 and 1995, Ted Kaczynski killed three people and injured 23 others in an attempt to start a revolution by conducting a nationwide bombing campaign targeting people involved with modern technology, end quote. Netflix has adapted a Reels two-night event from last month and renamed it. It's now a four-parter. And the limited series, quote, highlights a never-before-heard prison interview conducted in 1999, in which Kaczynski describes the origins and execution of his personal war against society, as well as his disdain for the FBI. They said a mouthful. You have not a personal connection to this case, but it's sort of like geographical personal connection to the case. Do you want to talk about that at all?
A bit. And the funny thing is, the connection to the case was basically for a period of about 5 years, everybody just assumed I did have a connection to it because growing up in Montana and going to boarding school in the late 90s, there were kind of two things that people would associate with you when you'd say I'm from Montana. They would assume, oh, you either belong to the Freeman Militia or you knew the Unabomber. And this was basically like, these were the two Montana talking points you had on the East Coast when all of this was in the headlines.
Oof. Well, as someone who has had to develop various New Jersey talking points over the years, I get it. But that's a bad one.
I mean, everybody in New Jersey is part of The Sopranos, right? Mm-hmm. I just assumed.
Oh, yeah. Absolutely. I wish we'd have eaten a lot better. This series, I mean, it was fine. I was a little concerned when I realized that it had been adapted from reels or taken from reels or originated with reels. But it's competently put together. I wasn't bored, but I'm not convinced that it wouldn't have worked just as well as a podcast or as a feature documentary. I think the latter might have been better. How did you feel about it just as a sort of compositional prospect?
I did sort of feel like I was watching a bunch of visual aids thrown up against a podcast. I felt like I didn't have to watch the screen the whole time. There was not a lot of useful visuals in this thing.
Yeah, that's true. The reenactments are fairly standard. There aren't too many of them.
There's a lot of stock footage.
Yeah, there's a lot of stock footage. There's a lot of different camera angles within the same talking head interview that I'm not convinced are necessary, but generally speaking, from a production standpoint, it's fine. It's a notch above the usual reels product. But the source of the tape, this is like the only interview that he ever gave, basically, right? So you mentioned the significance of this particular interviewer. Do you want to talk about her?
Yeah, I think it's useful to note, and the first thing I did when the interviewer came up and kind of introduced herself, and she had been the editor of a publication called Earth First, and I had never heard of that, so I decided to see what it was the second it comes up. And they go into it, you get to about episode 3, and then they back up and they talk a little bit about why he chose her, of all people, to conduct the interview. I feel like this might have been a little bit better to have up front because it does kind of give you a little context. But Earth First is kind of this very fringy, far left eco-extremist newsletter. And in fact, Kaczynski notes that he enjoys their publication, but he didn't want to subscribe to their newsletter while he was out Unabomber because he didn't want to wind up on a list. So I think it's a notch above like being typed out manually on a typewriter and cut and pasted, but it seemed like it was about that level of fringiness.
Right. That there might have been a mimeograph involved.
I'm sure there was at some point. Like the first editions of this newsletter smelled really good.
Yeah. And faintly of blueberries, which is what they use to ink the Mimeo. Actually, in terms of the structuring, I did feel like that should have been a little bit clearer up front. Like, this didn't seem like someone who particularly cared what the lamestream media was going to say about him, or would have the means to read it in any case. And as well, there's a whole section in, they catch him, spoiler, I guess, early in the fourth and last episode. And then there's this whole, I hesitate to call it a fantasia, but I mean, obviously I don't hesitate that much, about these experiments that he was, these psychological experiments that he was involved in when he was at Harvard, when he was still in his teens, and that are now considered unethical. What did you think of that section?
Well, it was something, I think, this is not breaking news. I feel like this was something that they made a lot out of at the time when the mainstream media, or the lamestream media, as the fringe would probably refer to it.
Yeah.
I feel like this was something that they made a lot out of during his trial, and it was something I don't know that it necessarily paints a more well-rounded picture of the guy. And I guess this is kind of my gripe with the entire documentary series. I feel like maybe it's what it says on the tin. And in a lot of ways, this documentary, the bar was set a little low going in, and I think they exceeded my expectations in a lot of ways.
Yeah.
But when the title is Unabomber in His Own Words, I guess I can't be surprised when it paints him a little more sympathetically than maybe another documentary would. But I got the sense that they're really trying to sometimes justify his actions, like maybe he's not all bad. And the part about the experiments was, it was certainly interesting in a kind of a ghoulish, they can't look away sort of way, but it's also kind of piling on. They also talk a little bit about when he was a baby, this time he spent in the hospital and the doctors wouldn't let his parents hold him. And they think maybe this turned him into a psychopath. And I feel like I don't know that I necessarily need to come away from a documentary feeling sorry for the Unabomber. And it kind of invites me to do that.
Well, and also I think that there is this, instinct almost always in true crime stories to try to, if not diagnose exactly, then at least explain how this monster was created so that in theory the next monster like him is easier for us, the civilian, to spot. I think that's like a normal human drive to try to organize these agents, to organize your world despite the existence of these agents of chaos. However, I think his rationale was fairly straightforward, and the fact that even this documentary is like, but wait, there's more. Like, sometimes they just tell you why they did what they did. And it's not sympathetic because he's a fucking bomber. So...
Yeah, but my notes, I just have in all caps, you killed three people.
Yeah. There's also there's a segment in episode two. Well, we'll get to it. Our first clip in this section is one that you called for, and it is pretty much him talking the whole time. Do you want to make any comments before we hear that, or should we just hear it and then discuss?
I think it just basically sets up like what he is hoping to get when he called this editor to come in and interview him. He has okay. He has his goals for the event. So we'll just play the clip.
All right.
My personal preference is to be depicted truthfully. If I could be used as a symbol for promoting revolutionary activity, that's fine with me, because the main thing, in my opinion, to me, the main thing is to get rid of the industrial system by whatever means may be necessary.
Yeah, so two things here. The first thing is, you can tell it's a fringe publication because they can't afford a decent tape recorder. Yeah. And yeah, I guess it was 1999 and technology had not gotten to where it is now, but the audio quality on all of these Unabomber tapes is pretty rough. They had not digitized it or preserved it in any way. And the second thing is, you actually do get a pretty big segment in episode four of this series where he gets his platform, basically. You have experts coming in and saying, well, you know, if he hadn't blown people up, some of these ideas are pretty sound. And they show clips of people protesting, and they kind of juxtapose it like it's the same thing. And I thought that was a little bit... They did not attempt to humanize him as much as I thought they were going to going in, but that was still a strange moment to me.
Well, yeah, that they're sort of like, well, he accurately predicted, or like, well, he's not Nostradamus, like, unless Nostradamus blew people up, which I don't recall.
We don't know that he didn't.
That's true. But from the In Search Of episode that I watched, which makes me an authority, this is the internet after all, I didn't love that the documentary touched on this idea, which is sort of similar to Zodiac's communications with newspapers, that like what he wants is a platform so that he can control everyone by scaring them to death. So do you do that? Do you give him what he wants in that regard while hoping that someone recognizes his cadences or his handwriting and turns him in? I think that's a really interesting debate and where you put that line. And they breezed past it a little bit. But yeah, there was a little bit of like, I don't know. He'd be talking about how he, like, I've been against all technology since 1962. And then they show machines doing the work of workers, I guess. And it's like, I mean, are we supposed to side with him about the plight of the American worker? Like, it has nothing to do with the systems. He's just a sick guy.
Yeah, and I feel like if you want to know what he's about, you could go read the 45,000 words about it.
Yeah.
That's been written. It's in really tiny print in the New York Times.
Yeah. Like, this is what I was saying. He, I think, at no point was particularly cagey. Like, was he trying not to get caught and to throw attention onto someone else? Yes, and we'll get to it. But in the second clip, he's sort of talking about how he tried to just subtract himself from the world and technology, and the world and technology wouldn't allow it. Like, really, dude? Who was cannibalizing other people's cars to build bombs? Who, like, which system made you do that?
The United States
Postal Service that can't even get to your shack? Okay. Anyway, why don't I play clip three, which you also called for, and we can talk about that foolishness a little more.
Something.
One of the things that's very interesting about Kaczynski is the personal is political. Everything that he's writing about and talking about in the abstract is also related to very concrete experiences that Kaczynski has had.
I hate the system, not because of some abstract humanitarian principle, but because I hated living in the system, and I got out of it by getting into the mountains, but the system wouldn't let me alone.
I mean, this is where the portrait of Ted Kaczynski as misunderstood, rejected bomber, I mean, not that that was ever going to hold, but it pretty much falls apart for me when he's like, you know, she's talking about how the personal is political, which is sort of a nothing burger thing to say, is A. B, he's like, the system hated me first. Like, oh, here we are. Here we are at the problem.
Oh, it's society with a capital S.
Yes.
Got it. Although the documentary does kind of pivot away from this excuse making when they start to talk about how he was regarded by his neighbors. And there's a great anecdote where there are some local tourists riding motorbikes past his property and disturbing him. And so he goes with an axe and smashes up their cabin and takes a poop in their tub.
Yeah.
And I thought, okay, at least they understand that they're not working with a tortured, misunderstood genius who's rejected by society. At least the documentary is acknowledging that this is also the kind of guy that poops in people's tubs.
Yeah. Well, and I think not because he's unaware that that's inappropriate. It's because he is aware that that's inappropriate. Like, he wants things a certain way. And he moved as far away from other people as he could so that he could ensure that that would be true. But there is a moment in episode two where he's more or less credited with inventing inceldom in its most extreme form. This profiler tries to put it gently, but there's kind of no way to do that. Clip four.
He apparently had issues with his social awkwardness, and I think it was a turning point for him in a lot of ways in his thinking about his interaction with society.
There was a certain number of generations which had crisis, and I just felt so desperate. I felt so empty, I felt, and I just that reaching crisis and felt so desperate that I thought that
had difficulties with the opposite sex, and ultimately that manifested itself into some thoughts about actually killing people. He became that angry, I think maybe initially with himself and ultimately with society, because he felt that he was a victim to some extent.
Part of me feels like they probably could have started wrapping it up after that, at least in terms of analyzing him, because as I said before, I don't think it's actually that deep. He told us who he was through the bombs and then through the manifesto. I'm not sure you need to do that much more close reading. Would you agree?
I would agree, although I think there's something to be said for the anecdote where he is working for his brother and he meets a woman through work and pursues her romantically, is rejected, and then kind of goes off the deep end posting filthy limericks about her in the break room.
Yeah.
It's also, and I don't think anybody is supposed to extrapolate from that, that he's going to go on to blow up technology executives, but it's also an interesting peek into, I don't think it's necessarily anything to do with his specific issues to women. It's more like he just doesn't get along with people at all. He's got a people problem, not a women problem.
Yeah, I think that could be true. What did you think of the segment in which his abortive attempt to transition is, I guess, addressed?
That's so... I think the thing that they are trying to say there is that he knew there was something wrong with his identity and he didn't feel right where he was and assumed that that must have been the thing. That's a weird leap to come to.
Yeah, I mean, apparently this was a documented desire of his that he then walked back, which, I mean, I don't know. I just thought it was a strange thing to include, given that it didn't go anywhere and that the present day analysis of it seemed as baffled as anything else. Like, you know, then why even mention this?
Yeah, maybe they're trying to be completists here, but in every other regard, they do seem to be they're making a stab at being comprehensive. Like, I don't think there's anybody they interviewed that I feel like they needed to have somebody that wasn't there, for instance. But it's a weird tangent to go on if there's not going to be, and it doesn't seem like in real life there was any connection, that any direct line that could be drawn from that to anything else that happened to him.
Yeah, but it was extremely comprehensive, and I did find their level of access extremely impressive.
Yeah, it was great. They had pretty much everybody in town that was living there at the time, as well as, I think, maybe the most compelling storyteller in this whole thing is his own brother. And
oh, sure.
It looked like David Kaczynski basically gave them free reign of the entire family archives.
Yeah. Including a quite amazing picture, which will be in the visual aids. That's at Blotter Presents on Twitter, of the two brothers and a bird perched on Ted Kaczynski's shoulder. And he just has like this wiseacre face on that I found very funny. But they did get quite impressive involvement from various FBI agents, profilers, forensic psychiatrists. The fact that his brother and sister-in-law would participate and did not, I mean, these are people who've been living in the glare of this for a very long time, and they seemed sincere, but not like rehearsed or canned or anything like that.
Yeah. Well, I think David in particular has kind of, over the last 20 years or so, has really started to lean into this identity and realize that the only productive thing he can get out of this is to speak candidly about it. And he goes into how he has befriended one of the victims, and they have they have, you know, appeared at events together and they stay in pretty close touch, which I thought was really very interesting on both of their parts.
Yeah, I wonder if that would be, would that be more or less surprising to you if David weren't so involved in his brother's capture?
Yeah, I think that's got to be some of it, especially and he talks about, I think maybe the most compelling segment of the entire miniseries is his description of the agonizing process he went through when he realized, oh, this is maybe a credible clue that my brother could be the Unabomber and I need to turn him in, but I don't know what this will do to him. Will he get the death penalty? How do I move forward in life knowing that I'm the one responsible for turning him in? And then in the aftermath, being outed as the person that turned him in, which he did not expect. And I think that probably is the biggest influencer on the way that he responded to it.
The part that I found the most affecting in that journey for David was when he was talking about the box that the FBI found under his brother's bed in the shack.
Mm-hmm.
And it was, it was the next bomb that was like 93% built. And David's like, well, you know, that then I knew that I was right. And we saved one. And there's just something that about the way he says it. And you can feel him thinking about the people that, you know, they weren't able to get ahead of the process for, even though I think there's no reasonable expectation of that for him. Certainly I wouldn't expect him to be like looking for signs that your brother's a bomber. Like that's not a thing. So, I think this is something that, you know, he walks around with every day still, because that, you know, how do you not think about what might have happened? This person is not well, but he's like, he clearly knows what he's doing and is like, in addition to being a murderer, he's also kind of a jackass. I found this thing on Wikipedia.
Yes.
In 2012, Kaczynski responded to the Harvard Alumni Association's directory inquiry for the 50th reunion of the class of 1962. He listed his occupation as prisoner and his 8 life sentences as awards.
Oh, come on. I think that's maybe the only time I actually liked him.
Yeah. I mean, the prisoner part was sort of funny.
You've had to write to your college alumni association and tell them what you're up to, and it's exhausting. So I think anything anybody can do to make that process, like, I don't think it makes up for anything he's ever done, but I did get a chuckle out of it.
Well, and the fact that they found him, that they bothered.
Well, I don't think he's hard to track down anymore.
Well, yeah. How many Kaczynskis are there in Florence Supermax? Probably just the one.
If there's two, they get each other's mail all the time, so they know each other and it's not a big deal.
It's Kaczynski with two Z's. I keep telling him. Oh, man. He also, I don't think anything came of this, but I love that parts of it were gently reenacted. Clip 5.
In order to put the FBI off their track, he deliberately went to a men's room in the bus station, picked up a number of pubic hairs, and brought them back and inserted them in his next bomb so that when the FBI did their analysis of the bombing, that they would find DNA strands that had nothing to do with him.
Couple notes here. Actually, just the one, which is if the FBI did find these pube fragments in the bomb detritus, in what malign universe in Kaczynski's head are other bombers squatting over their bombs with no pants on and just shedding pubes. Like, how, regardless of whose pube it is, how does that work? Like, maybe look for a head hair? Do you know what I mean?
Well, maybe he did look for head hairs and there weren't any in the men's room.
Then look again. This is not how this works, Mr. Kaczynski. Professor.
Well, he did seem to think that the FBI was kind of a joke, so it's a little bit Wile E. Coyote working blue, but it's also everything that he felt about the FBI at that point, he assumed they would fall for it.
Yeah, I mean, and I don't think at that point that was necessarily the wrong inference to draw on his part, because he was playing it pretty smart up to a certain point. Like, it did take a tip. I thought it was interesting that the FBI was given ample time to respond to these comments in this documentary and be like, well, look, he did everything right. He left no, you know, forensic material for us to even test. We weren't getting any tips. It's a bomber. This is how they get away with it. What did you want us to do?
Yeah, and the guy that they have speaking on behalf of the FBI, he gave off the aura that he has been asked these questions a lot of times and he's getting real tired of having to defend himself and his organization. Like, he almost looks like he's about to burst out laughing at the ridiculousness of every subsequent question at a certain point. And there's a point where he is describing the letter that Kaczynski has written calling the FBI a joke, and he just gets this look like, he called me a joke. I was upset. What do you want me to do? I mean, he's a great storyteller and I appreciated having his perspective in there, but it really, he's told the story a few times already and it's starting to hurt his feelings.
There are sometimes case personages in documentaries and whatever newsmag stories of this type where you get the distinct feeling that the individual is working so hard not to swear on camera that you're not really getting the full flavor of the story that you might get over a couple of inches of brown liquor, for example. I didn't feel like he had that problem. He seemed fairly comfortable, you know, annoyed, like you said, but comfortable on camera. But I do wonder if after, certain number of McAllen that he might have a different version. And I actually wouldn't mind the salty, cursy version.
So, like drunk history, but true crime.
Yes. Oh my gosh.
Oh, I'd hear for that.
Yeah. I was just watching A Drunk History before we started recording. It never disappoints. It really doesn't.
It's true. It doesn't matter who they've got doing it. It's always great.
All right. We have one clip left in this section, which is the brother David attempts to read the manifesto and the fact that he is obliged to use the internet to find it. Life's Little Ironies, clip 6.
The college library had the issue, but somebody had taken the manifesto out of it, so it wasn't there, and I'm ready to throw up my hands. And then she says, the internet. Now, I had hardly heard of the internet. We didn't have it at home, but they had it at the college library. Linda's sitting next to me. And first of all, it's kind of weird. Here I am in this newfangled technology trying to figure out if my brother is the anti-technology terrorist. You know, I felt almost like guilty about doing that.
It's very of an era.
Yeah. He really is. He is very charming is not quite the right word, but he has exactly the right charisma for this, David Kaczynski. So you could tell that this was difficult for him, but I thought he did a good job and really made this seem like he gave it that heft, I thought.
Yeah, and the credibility, I think. I would personally not want to watch any documentary on the Unabomber that didn't get his perspective.
Yeah, or that didn't have... I think that there have probably been enough sort of like 48 Hours looks back at the Unabomber, and it's a bunch of people who weren't directly involved in the case and, you know, can talk about it third hand. There's a little of that happening, like that... that psychologist, Sasha Reed, who looks like Stephanie March to a disconcerting degree, so it was sort of hard for me to focus on what she was actually saying.
Yeah, she did seem kind of pulled out of a Law and Order episode.
Yeah, just an exposition what we're talking about. And it wasn't necessary, but it also wasn't intrusive. But I think that, especially with this subject, if you can't get this many people who, like, actually touched the case or were touched by the case, then you're best off not doing it, which would explain why this felt quite a bit less cynical and slapped together than a lot of real stuff does, because it's people who were there and obliged to care about it.
Yeah, again, this exceeded my expectations going in. I was worried that it was just basically we were going to hear a lot more of the echoey tape juxtaposed over stock footage and a few people peripherally connected to it. But it really, it went deep. And I don't think it necessarily, I was not surprised by anything I learned necessarily, but I feel like it wasn't a complete waste of time.
No, it definitely wasn't. It could have been shorter, and there were some like placement issues of some materials, and the whole like experiments thing, like mention it in the timeline when he's off to Harvard and then drop it, I guess. I don't know. There are a couple of quibbles, but I would recommend it overall. You?
Yeah, I would definitely recommend it, especially like if it's something that you're looking for a really broad overview of what that whole case was about. I think it stands up really well and gives you everything you need.
And now a word from our sponsor, Best Fiends. I really like reviewing true crime, obviously, but even I need the occasional break from it. I also am obliged to make the occasional trip to the post office or DMV, so when I feel like I need a mental palate cleanser or I just want to get lost in something fun while I'm waiting in a line, my new go-to is Best Fiends. Best Fiends is a puzzle game with a story and lots of fun sound effects. It's a casual game anyone can play, although it's made for adults, and you can spend as much or as little time as you'd like in the game. I've been on the much side of that equation since downloading Best Fiends. The puzzles are challenging enough that I'm determined to keep trying until I clear a tough level, but not so challenging that I want to give up or that I couldn't get to level 38 in just a few days. I like the jazzy music, the insect protagonists are super cute, and the slug villains are hilariously grumbly, but I think what I like best is that the game always remembers where I am and drops me right back in where I left off, no problem. And I recently discovered on a plane trip that you don't need the internet to play Best Fiends, so I knocked off a bunch of levels in airplane mode and then at the rental car counter. Play on the subway, play at your grandparents who don't have Wi-Fi, play anywhere. And if you are playing anywhere and all the time, Best Fiends updates the game monthly with new levels and events, so it never gets old. Engage your brain with fun puzzles and collect tons of cute characters. Trust me, with over 100 million downloads, this 5-star rated mobile puzzle game is a must play. Download Best Fiends free on the Apple App Store or Google Play. That's friends without the R, Best Fiends. Moving on to our second most wanted section. We are talking about a podcast that dropped its first episode last month. It's called Strictly Stalking. I believe we're up to episode 4 or 5, but we're focusing primarily on the second episode. I believe I will put a content warning here for stalking, and there are mentions of suicide in the episode that we're talking about. As always, please listen and watch with care for yourselves. Here's the case file from the podcast's landing page. Strictly Stalking is a true crime podcast that starts before others at the stalking. Each week, hosts Jamie Beebe and Jake Deptula dive into unique stalking cases, interviewing stalker victims and anyone involved in the case. Jess, this was your suggestion. Why did you want us to talk about this one?
I first encountered this. There's been an advertising blitz for this podcast on just about everything. Every podcast I listen to has had an ad drop for this in the last couple of months. And it's such a compelling premise and such an interesting idea that hasn't really been done.
Yeah.
And I listened to it, and it's not a perfect thing, but it is really compelling. It is such a interesting, comprehensive way of telling the story. And there's a lot they don't get right that I thought was kind of emblematic of ways that this genre doesn't get things right that I thought was interesting to talk about. But then the actual storytelling of it all is also worth calling out.
They choose interviewees, or they have so far, who are extremely organized and cogent and concise. I mean, not necessarily concise, but these are people who know how to craft this story, unfortunately, probably because they had to do it so many times for law enforcement and various other entities before they were believed and taken seriously. I think certainly in episode 2, that's the sense you get, that she has been over this ground many, 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 many times, trying to get restraining orders, trying to get LAPD to listen to her about this guy. So there's that. But then, unfortunately, the podcast itself is like not content to just interview them and shape that in the editing and not have these extremely stilted interstitials that don't even match in terms of room tone. Like, the hosts don't match each other in terms of room tone. It's very weird. I'm not sure how to fix it except by just deleting the hosts.
You know, maybe it is a question of needing different hosts, because I think from a production standpoint, I think this is a very well-edited podcast. And to your point, the actual first-person interviewees are very good at telling their story and encapsulating what happened to them, and which I think is probably mostly on them, but also in terms of they know what pieces to highlight and how to gloss over it. But I think the actual narrators, and these are people that come from, their background is mostly in the entertainment world.
Right.
And they kind of come on like they are commentating on a TMZ episode.
Yeah. Yeah. I struggle with like faulting them for something that I don't think they chose the structure of this production. And if the idea is like occasionally we'll drop the hosts in to make a comment and then throw to the next segment as like a segue, I just don't think it's necessary. I think you could put like a music sting in there, and then we would understand what's happening because we understand how people talk and how stories work. And inevitably there's like some clunky written sounding reaction, and then they just repeat what we've just heard. So unfortunately, like when they're participating in the interview portions, that feels much more natural. And like they are evoking, you know, they are participating and they are meaningful to the interview process. But the interstitial stuff is just.
Yeah, I think maybe they need a third person in there who is like a narrator with actual gravitas, because I think everybody pulls as their inspiration when they're putting together a podcast that's kind of journalist-y and storytelling-y like this. Everybody goes to NPR for this, but that's because NPR, that's how they structure it. You have somebody that speaks for a length of time, and then you compress what happens in the middle there by having a narrator kind of come on and gloss over some things and move you to the next talking point. And that might solve the problem of filling in the context that you need, or you just give the narrator, or you give the interviewee a little more room to get where she's going.
Yeah. I mean, it's an interesting question, because people don't, you know, I've done dozens of interviews and transcribed dozens of interviews. And the difference between, say, how Yahoo wanted a finished product interview and what I would have done on Previously.tv or Television Without Pity, which was to leave in every and ah, because I think that gives you a better sense of how the person's mind is working and how they're working through the answer. Yahoo is not interested in that. They want the soundbite. Fine. So I think that this podcast is maybe trying to have that both ways, that they're like, you know, the experienced podcast listener is accustomed here to a little, you know, aural break in the story. And so we're just going to put this joint in, even though we don't need it. But then they also let the speakers, the subjects, kind of talk, and this is how stories go. There's like a lot of doubling back, and there's a lot of repeating of phrases, and that's not uninteresting to me. Particularly Lenora Claire, like the amount of verbiage she can pack into 20 seconds is really impressive. But she doesn't necessarily need that NPR-ish, like, you know, here's someone's sonorous tones just reminding you, here's where we've been, and now here's where we're going. Like, you don't necessarily need it. For an example of how good a storyteller she is in episode 2, why don't we play clip 7?
What happened? So, sure enough, he shows up to kidnap me. I was actually on the other side of the building when this happened. But what, so, and you'll love this part of the story. Dudes dressed as Batman and Superman in their cosplay outfits held him down with security.
That's amazing.
Until LAPD picked his ass up and then took him in. And then while he was in holding, the Kardashians, of course, served their restraining order, which I knew. Out of nowhere, Gwyneth Paltrow serves her restraining order. I did not know she was in the mix.
Oh, wow.
Apparently, and I read this, I think it might have been on The Blast, or when he tried to kidnap her kid from school. Okay, so I don't even know she was in the mix. So,
I mean, that's a really great example of, I guess we should give some context for that story. But on the other hand, do we even need to? Like, there's like every famous person in it, and then superheroes tackled a guy who changed his name legally to Cloud Star Chaser, because that's where that was.
Yeah, this was such a layered story. I have no idea how this guy found the time to accomplish the level of stalking that he got up to, which was maybe the most perplexing part of the entire thing.
And there were a number of stalking like journeys that he was on in parallel to each other.
And yeah, I mean,
he's Lenora like, mentions, and then he escapes from custody, and then he's picked up while stalking Ivanka Trump. Sure.
Yeah, and I enjoyed that Lenora was very clear about, Ivanka Trump couldn't get this guy served with a felony, but I managed to get it done.
Yeah.
And I was like, yeah, you go.
Yeah, I think while listening to it, I may have muttered something about, like, just another thing Ivanka Trump doesn't know how to do.
Oh,
well,
snap.
Yeah. Hashtag vote Warren. Her story is just amazing, and the way she tells it is amazing. And then in episode 3, they're talking to pageant women about the stalkers that they've encountered, and you're kind of secondarily getting a little behind the scenes information about the pageant world, little processy stuff about that. And they're talking about the difference in not just pageanting, but also in stalking. I mean, that sounds flip, but you know what I mean. Now that social media is has many more tentacles in all of our lives. So this podcast is like, there is definitely value in it. I was not bored. I was just frequently like chafing at the way that this really interesting, important topic was kind of stepping on its own dick with the structure. So that's where I was with it. Have you listened to all of the episodes?
Yeah, I have listened to all the episodes, and it does, they have not gotten any better in that regard. But every episode so far has brought something new to the table as far as kind of the conundrums that people face in trying to get their cases in front of law enforcement and what the pushback they get and how they are helped and what finally they are able to do to get the help they need and how they are able to kind of come out the other side. Some people are very much not on the other side of it, which I think is also valuable. And I think it really helps anybody that has been on the other side of that to see what kinds of like records are helpful to keep and what kinds of things you have to say to what kinds of people to get anything accomplished. I think that's really helpful. The thing that I wonder, 5 episodes in, is how long could a show like this bring something new to the table before they get repetitive? And it seems like so far the answer is a lot longer than I initially thought, but there's some potential pitfalls there where you could get to a point where someone comes on with a story that is maybe not entirely on the up and up. I'm thinking about latter seasons of Catfish, the series, for instance.
Oh, you're the one thinking of latter seasons.
The only one. Yes.
Do you think there's the potential for like stalkers themselves? Because I haven't listened to all the episodes. Do you think that there's the potential for stalkers themselves to like abuse this resource or like pervert it for their own? Because the podcast description says they talk to stalkers. Has that happened yet?
It has not happened yet. And I think that it may be badly placed punctuation there. Like they may be just interviewing stalker victims.
Oh, okay. Or so that was actually supposed to be an apostrophe and not a comma?
Yeah, I think maybe, and I don't know, they might have something else planned for a subsequent episode. There is, in episode 5, there is a point where I started to be a little concerned that if they are, because they were so kind of forthcoming about who the stalker was, and this person is apparently out in the world and is not serving any time at the moment, it sure seems to me like it's a calculated risk that a victim might take to speak out about what's happening to them. And I think in some cases you would assume, knowing the mindset of a stalker, it would perhaps embolden them and feel like, oh, I'm getting some attention. They're talking about me on a podcast. It clearly means we're married now.
Right. Well, and I was seeing on the Apple Podcasts ratings, like in the reviews for Strictly Stalking, that they gave the subject a pseudonym, but then mentioned the real name several times by mistake. So one would hope that that would be edited or re-released with that information.
Yes.
Scotched. There is something like sadly, not sadly familiar, but as you're listening to these episodes, they make references to these notorious cases of stalking, of identity theft, identity fraud, that, and they don't explain the references, and they don't have to. And there's just something so grievous about that the audience for this podcast does not have to have it explained to them who Rebecca Schaefer is or who Dirty John is, for example. And that,
well,
yeah,
they know who they're talking to. I think they have a very clear sense of who this is for. And I think that's to their credit.
Yeah, that's true. You called for another clip from this episode. Do you want to intro that?
I think this is just kind of emblematic of, I was particularly impressed with Lorna Claire's ability to spin a story and to also the way that she has emerged from her stalking case as an advocate for victims and a resource. And I liked the way that she phrased this, this here in this clip.
That's all it is.
There's no how-to guide to go through what you've gone through. And you've actually, unfortunately...
Until maybe I write one.
What's that?
Until maybe I write
right.
one.
That's
so I guess one half.
No, that's basically part of your purpose is to be able to encourage women to come forward and anyone that needs help with this. Because, again, you need kind of that, for lack of a better term, a cheat sheet in order to figure anything out. You know, the confusion is mass.
And that's what happens is they Google it. I swear to God that Vice article is what pops up. And then they find me on Instagram and then I get on Skype with them. And by the end of the day, I'm like, all right, what state you live in? Okay, the TRO is this. I'm like, that's what I do. And I'm like, I'm not a lawyer and I'm not law enforcement, but I can tell you what worked for me. And that's the conversation I've had. I don't even know how many times.
I just really loved her attitude there. Like, she sounds kind of tired and over it, but not of people reaching out to her, but of just law enforcement still not being on the stick with this stuff.
And I guess I'm just glad that there's someone out there who can be this resource. And it sucks that we need someone like that, but I guess she's sort of the hero Gotham needs.
And seems, I'm sure this is not true, or it's sort of changeable from day to day, but she seems to not resent it or really consider it a burden, that she's like, well, this is what it is. She seems pretty matter of fact about it. And she's a casting agent also. It's not like she doesn't have her own work to do when she's not hanging out with Bill Jensen, which made me smile. Oh, Bill now? Is this William Joel? Oh God. Well, we have one more clip from this section where they're talking about what it might look like if we had a sex offenders registry, a federal stalker registry, and how that might affect the purchase of firearms in our last clip.
You know, with my stalker, one of the things, in California, we have it so that if you've got a domestic violence conviction, you can't get a gun. That's awesome, right? Why don't we have it that if you have restraining orders, you can't get guns? There should be.
Totally.
That would be key.
Come on. And with a stalking registry, the only reason why I know about all these other people who have restraining orders against my stalker is because my story is public, so they write me and tell me whatever.
Right. Mm-hmm.
But look at Dirty John, right?
Totally.
Okay. If we had a registry, you'd be able to, or online dating, you'd just look up your person and be like, they have 3 restraining orders. I don't want to go on this date, you know?
Yeah, I do know.
She has a bucket of really great ideas.
Yeah.
And I liked the one where the stalker has to wear a tracking collar and then your app gets pinged if they're coming near you.
Yes.
That's great.
I mean, and it's not like we don't have the technology for this. Grandparents know how to use the, Ring technology.
It's definitely doable. And I think I think maybe the thing I liked about her most is that she had so many really good ideas that probably won't get any traction in the current climate, but I appreciate the sentiment anyway.
Well, and she's also pretty good friends with old Adam Schiff, so
That's true. I mean,
if anyone is gonna move this ball, it's her.
It's really, I think it's, there have been so many badly done true crime stories where someone is a victim and then emerges the other side, like the phoenix rising from the ashes to advocate for the downtrodden. And I think this subverts all of the things I do not like about those stories.
Yeah, that's a good point. And I have to say, as chafy as the build of this makes me, and as you know, pessimistic as I am about improvement, there is something heartening about a podcast that's just premised, without even saying so, on believing women.
I think you hit the nail on the head. I think that's the most appealing thing about this format and this podcast, is that we're just going to let them tell their stories. And I hope they iron out the hosting segments, because I think that will make for a much better end product.
I agree. And maybe just get rid of them entirely, because you can hear in a couple of the clips that we played, like when they turn up, like in the tape, they're fine. They're natural. And like the phrasing "confusion is mass," like I never had said that way before. I was like, wait, is that a, oh yeah, that works. Okay. All right, Jake, sure. I get it. So that podcast is called Strictly Stalking. It's available wherever you get your podcasts. And let us know what you thought of it, because I think I'm going to keep going with it and just do that thing where I talk back to the console in the car, because that's where I'm at with a lot of podcasts, and it's okay.
Are there any podcasts that we're not at with that?
Yeah, I mean, I talk to my own at this point, so it's fine.
Same.
Well, thank you for bringing this to my attention, and thank you for coming on the podcast. It's been a delight. I hope you come back.
Oh, anytime. This was really so much fun.
Before I release you.
In local news today, bees.
Where else can listeners find your works and days?
Well, right now I am doing 2 weekly podcasts over on postshowrecaps.com. Postshow Recaps is basically what it says on the tin. We cover various scripted television, and my co-host Josh Wigler and I are going to be picking up the second half of The Walking Dead season this week. And I also cover Star Trek Picard with the incredible Mike Bloom. And then in writing form, you can occasionally find my feature articles over on primetimer.com.
Outstanding. Thank you again.
Thank you so much.
Coming up on The Blotter Presents, frankly, I'm not sure. Don't know who's going to be here. Don't know what we're going to be talking about. Because here's the thing. February shot all of true crime out of a cannon into my office, and I'm still cleaning up. Until then, if you've got a tip for The Blotter Presents, find me on social media. Blotter Presents on Twitter and the Gram, and in the Best Evidence newsletter, bestevidence.fyi. Today's episode was sponsored by Best Fiends. Download it free from the Apple App Store or Google Play. My guest has been Jessica Lease, and she's on Twitter at HaymakerHattie, 2 T's in Hattie. I'm Sarah D. Bunting, just 1 T in Bunting, and I confidentially inform you that I hope you'll tune in next time.